I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Effective teachers are the key to student success. Yet, our school systems treat teachers as interchangeable parts rather than professionals. That's the problem explored in a new report from the New Teacher Project called The Widget Effect. We'll talk with Timothy Daly about the report and why excellent teachers are not one size fits all. And with summer finally here, we'll talk to the creator of a unique travel website that shows you the spots you won't find in any guidebook. Bart Van Pol of the site Spotted by Locals is our guest. We'll also talk with Joel Mills of the American Institute of Architects about a program that helps communities develop sustainability solutions. We'll find out about the Sustainable Design Assessment Team's latest projects. Stay with us for Smart City coming up after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. If teachers are so important, why do we treat them like interchangeable parts? That's the question behind the Widget Effect, a new study from the New Teacher Project. The New Teacher Project is a national nonprofit dedicated to ensuring that high-need students get outstanding teachers. There is increasing agreement that putting quality teachers in the classroom is the single most important thing we can do to improve student performance. So I asked Timothy Daly, head of the New Teacher Project, what defines a quality teacher?
It's an interesting question. So you could answer that question by saying, in reality, in practice currently, how do we define quality teaching, or how should we define quality teaching? The way that we think about it is that good teachers get a response from students that leads those students to produce a quality and quantity of work that helps them meet standards. So we would define it not in terms of what the teacher is doing, but how the kids are responding to the teaching.
How is a quality teacher defined today?
So for decades, teaching practice has generally been measured by adults watching other adults teach and categorizing the actions that they see in front of the room, regardless of how the kids are responding to what's going on in the front of the room. Typically, it's been checklists of behaviors, and those checklists oftentimes include significant numbers of things that we don't even believe contribute meaningfully to student learning.
Give me some examples. What would be on that checklist, and what are the things on that checklist you think don't count?
So a common indicator that you'll see on a teacher evaluation form would be cleanliness of the room. So it might be important for the room to be clean, but we have no evidence that students that are in a clean room end up learning more than students that are in a room that's only somewhat clean.
Good example. Why aren't we doing a better job of measuring teacher performance?
In the process of writing this report, we found that this goes back decades, much longer than we thought. There's really only been one purpose for teacher evaluation, and that purpose has been to determine whether or not someone is so bad that they should be fired, or that they are not so bad that they need to be fired. And if you are only trying to make that decision, you can use a pretty blunt instrument to do that. For instance, principals, if they walk into a classroom and they see that the teacher is mediocre, but they're nowhere near bad enough to be fired, there's not a lot for them left to do. They're going to fill out the checklist, and they're going to move on to the next classroom. They tend to spend most of their time in classrooms where the instruction is very poor because they're trying to document it so they can fire that teacher. But one reason that evaluation is so poor is that the purposes that evaluations have been used for are so low level.
Low level meaning it's the blunt instrument to say if you're so bad, you need to leave.
That's
we want
correct.
To document it, and anything else will do.
That's correct. And what they haven't been used for is what we often say they're supposed to be used for. So oftentimes we say that an evaluation is supposed to help assess where a teacher is so we can help that teacher get better. So you would assume that you'd be trying to differentiate very good instruction from just okay instruction and okay instruction from poor instruction. But in reality, that doesn't happen. We generally lump all the teachers that are not ineffective into one bucket. And that's where we got the title of this report, The Widget Effect, because essentially teachers are treated as interchangeable parts as long as they don't malfunction.
What prompted you to write or to begin the research that resulted in The Widget Effect?
In conversations that we've had about teacher effectiveness for years, one of the issues that comes up over and over and over again is we can't improve teacher effectiveness because we can't fire bad teachers. And so oftentimes that conversation would devolve into a debate about whether the reason for the lack of dismissals was that it was impossible to do it because the rules were so hard to follow or the unions resisted it. Or on the other hand, some folks would say it's not impossible to do. It's just that principals and districts are so incompetent that they don't do it. We were originally interested in separating myth from fact. act around that and figuring out why it was that dismissal seemed to be so rarely used. And that line of inquiry led into other lines of inquiry.
And so what did you find?
We found that the problem is so much worse than just a lack of dismissals. What we found was a culture of indifference to the quality of instruction, that in many districts, they could not tell you who their best teachers were or who their worst teachers were, and they weren't doing anything to help make sure the good teachers stayed, or that the teachers in the middle got better, or that the teachers at the bottom improved or left. They really weren't doing anything about any of these different groups of teachers. And it led to a whole host of consequences that we didn't realize were interconnected. So for instance, if you think that teachers are interchangeable, that would explain why you pay teachers all the same, regardless of their effectiveness, and just distinguish them based on seniority. It would also explain why, when there is professional development for teachers, you send them to a one-size-fits-all workshop, because you really are treating them as one-size-fits-all. It also explains why, when teachers come up for tenure, 99.5% of them, or something on that order, get tenure, because you're treating them as interchangeable unless they are documented to be so poor that they can't be in front of kids. So the consequences that we found were that we just stopped paying attention to maximizing teacher effectiveness because we weren't even assessing it in the first place.
That's such a grim bit of news. I mean, what you're describing is a culture of overwhelming neglect to quality employees. Can you change that?
It's a good question. One of the things that should give us pause in thinking about how to change it is that it's been in place for decades. So one of the things that we quote in the report itself is an article from the New York Times that describes this mass frustration with the evaluation system in New York City. And it describes that there's only two ratings teachers can get, satisfactory or unsatisfactory, and all the teachers get satisfactory. And people have a lack of confidence in the judgment of principals to assign those ratings because one principal may have one standard and another principal may have a different standard. The article was written in 1936.
Oh.
And in the 73 years since the article was written, New York has not changed its evaluation scale. It hasn't changed the number of years that it takes to get tenure. And that article was written before teachers' unions had the right to collectively bargain in New York City. So these problems go back to the Great Depression, if not earlier. And it's possible to change it, but we believe that it requires a culture shift in addition to a shift in policy and in the way that we implement those policies.
Well, culture shift is harder than policy to change. So how do you begin that culture shift?
We think there are two main issues that have to be addressed for this problem to be alleviated. First is we have to commit to differentiating levels of teacher performance, not just saying whether teachers are competent or incompetent. And that means that we have to have instruments that are sensitive enough to differentiate, and we have to have staff that are strong enough to differentiate in the form of administrators or peer reviewers. And we have to align evaluation with professional development, meaning that we have to have some meaningful way that we react to the evaluations once they're done, so teachers are actually getting better. And then once we have done professional development, we need to evaluate those teachers again to find out whether it works. So the first main component is differentiate teacher performance and align professional development to it. And then the second major category is that we have to use these evaluations for more than just dismissal. And that's where we get into some sensitive territory, where we're arguing that you should use the evaluations when you're making decisions like which teachers need to be laid off if positions are cut from the district. You should use evaluations for decisions like deciding how quickly teachers progress up the salary scale. And those are things that we've not used evaluations for in the past. Our argument is that if you don't use evaluations for things that are positive, that teachers want, and if all you use them for is sanctioning teachers, they're always going to be a negative experience, and they're always going to receive very little attention, because the truth is there aren't that many ineffective teachers. And if evaluations are only used to root out the ineffective teachers, they're irrelevant for everyone else.
You're talking about developing a mechanism, an evaluation mechanism, that has to be administered by people who are part of this culture.
Yes.
Who have come up through this culture.
Yes.
That seems to me to be a really difficult shift to make. How do you make this change while the plane is flying?
It's exceptionally difficult. I think what you're identifying is probably the biggest challenge, which is that we're asking adults to evaluate in a high-stakes way people that they see on an everyday basis that they may have hired into the school building. And in education, we have a culture where, just as we believe that every student can improve, we've often tended to believe that every teacher can improve. And there are so many options currently available to administrators besides directly addressing the issue. And what I mean by options is that in most cases when a teacher is not performing well, the principal finds a way for that teacher to leave their school building, but they very rarely exit the district or exit the profession. And in many cases, those workaround solutions have become the norm. And it's created a culture where a principal who actually addresses ineffective performance is viewed as vindictive or mean because everyone knows that there are these other workaround solutions available. And I think changing the culture requires sending a clearer message to principals about the importance of this, training them to do it, and frankly, holding them accountable for doing it. Because right now, a principal can rate 100% of their teacher superior every year, and no one will ever have a conversation with them about that.
How did you come to this work, Tim?
I was a teacher in Baltimore City. I was a middle school teacher through Teach for America. And it was clear that in my school, we had a wide variation of quality of instruction. And in particular, when I was a second-year teacher, we had a teacher on my team that taught English that was particularly ineffective and had been known to be ineffective. And I went into my principal's office one day and asked why we weren't doing something about it. And she said that this teacher had been at half of the middle schools in Baltimore over the years, and that even though she wasn't a very good teacher, it would take 2 years to document her performance and potentially get her out of the district, and that once we got her out, they would just send her someone else from downtown who was probably just as bad, and that she had a way of working with this ineffective teacher that made her less of a problem than she otherwise would be. And so my principal had just made the strategic decision to continue tolerating it. And you could see the students that went through this class day after day after day who weren't learning anything. But I realized that until my principal had a better option than the options that were on the table, she was not going to take action. And it got me very interested in the question of how you ensure that students who come from high-need backgrounds not only have access to great instruction, but have some protection from very poor instruction.
Can you make a fair teacher good and a good teacher great?
We think so, but the truth is that so little has been done with most teachers that we think it's premature to make a guess either way. There is so little cohesiveness.
Really?
To the professional development that goes on in most districts that what we know from the research is that teachers that start out well tend to continue doing well, continue to grow at very fast rates. And teachers that start their careers out very poorly tend to stay less effective. What we don't know is whether if you intervened early in a teacher's career and gave them very rigorous development that was aligned to standards, whether those teachers could improve more rapidly than they would now because we provide them next to no assistance. And so I guess the jury is still out on that. What we heard from teachers in course of doing this study was that they believe that there are a significant number of their colleagues that have been performing poorly for an extended period of time, and they seem to be less than confident that can be remediated. I would say we're not sure yet.
Just as children graduating from high school without the ability to get into a community college begs the question of the quality of education they're getting, it seems to me that teachers who perform poorly in the classroom but graduated from a college, a department of education, begs the question what kind of education they're getting. So to the extent that you identify this widget effect and that you say we know there are a lot of ineffective teachers coming into classrooms, how is it they're getting out of college with a teacher's certificate?
It's a very good question. One of the things that researchers have told us over the last couple of decades is that it is very difficult to predict who is going to be an effective teacher prior to seeing them in the classroom. And the reason is that teaching is a response-based profession. It's a profession where a person is trying to provoke a specific learning response in students. And some people are very good at doing that, even if they don't have the most rigorous academic background. And some people with amazing academic backgrounds who have superior education of their own and a love of their content area are not able to reach the students.
So why don't we put sophomores in departments of education in classrooms and figure out if they're any good at it?
It's one thing that people are thinking more about is how you give prospective teachers a chance to be in front of students to rate that performance before you commit to having them in the classroom full time. There are some programs in cities like Boston and Chicago where they do residencies. They put teachers in a school environment for an entire year where they're not the teacher of record before they put them in there as the teacher of record. And during that time, they assess how well they're progressing. And I think that has a lot of potential.
One of the questions I have, Tim, as I think about the need for great teachers. If great teachers in a classroom are the key to improving education, are there enough great teachers? I mean, can we produce enough great teachers who want to be there to make the system work? Or are we in trouble with that finding?
We think that it's possible to do it because we've shown in many districts that we're able to get enormous numbers of people interested in the profession. So, for example, in New York City, where we run a program to help people change careers to become teachers, last year we received 20,000 applicants for only about 1,300 to 1,400 positions.
Wow.
We think that there are a lot of professionals that want to get into the classroom that would answer the call if we said, don't just be a teacher, but be an excellent teacher, become an effective teacher, and work with students that really need you. We think that the profession does need to change in some fundamental ways. And one of the ways it needs to change is that people need to feel that it's prestigious and that not everybody can be a teacher. They also need to feel that good teachers can make a living comparable to what professionals can make in other fields. And lastly, I think they need to feel like this is a profession where they're going to have colleagues of high quality. They want to work with other people that are high performers instead of feeling like they are somebody who shuts their door and does their work alone, because most people want to feel like they're part of a bigger team. So there are a lot of people that want to teach in high need areas. The question is, do we currently know what it takes to keep our good teachers over time? We tend to think of in teaching of what is the retention rate, how many teachers are staying. But what we don't think about is whether we're keeping our best teachers or our worst teachers. Because if you just think about how many teachers stay, you're placing a high value on the teachers staying who should actually go. And you may be losing teachers who should stay. So what we would advise is to get a very good teacher in every classroom, we're going to have to make some judgments about which teachers are our most effective and focus on retaining them. And then we're going to have to focus on recruiting people to replace the ones who leave, who shouldn't be here.
I was talking with one of your colleagues recently, and we were discussing this subject of teacher tenure. We were discussing specifically Teach for America and the short tenure of those teachers. And your colleague said to me, I'm becoming convinced that perhaps we should not be focused on teacher tenure, that in fact, we need to accept perhaps as the new normal, that people will come into classrooms for shorter periods of time, do very well while they're there, and then go on to other careers. What's your response to that?
I think on one hand, you could argue that what matters is not how long someone stays, but how effective they are when they're there. And also, what is our ability if that teacher leaves to find another effective teacher to take their place? So I think it is true that we may have people that choose to stay for shorter lengths of time in the profession. On the other hand, it's very important that we do everything we can to maximize the retention rate of very effective teachers, because the more years they teach, the more students benefit from them. And currently, we don't have very many tools to help us retain those teachers. So for instance, a teacher could be the best teacher in their school by their fourth year, but it may take them 25 years to reach the top of the salary scale. So we're not able to incentivize them to stay in teaching by accelerating their movement up the salary scale. In fact, they make the same amount in their fourth year as a fourth-year teacher who is one whisker above being dismissed. So I think that while it's true that we won't be able to keep everyone for an entire career, we should have many more tools at our disposal to make sure that teachers who like teaching and want to stay have every possible incentive to stay in the classroom where they can do the most good.
Explain the work of New Teacher Project, because you've been at this job of finding more and better teachers for school systems, working in on the ground, in the field, at local school systems for some time now.
We focus on inner city and rural public schools, schools that have large numbers of poor and minority children. So the first thing to keep in mind is that though we work in many different cities, our focus is with those particular groups of students. The second thing is that we basically use two different tools to increase the concentration of very effective teachers who work with those poor and minority children. And those two tools are increasing the pipeline of educators that are very effective. And then the second one is making sure that we maximize the way that we manage their effectiveness on the job. So we think first about bringing talented people into the profession and making sure that they reach a level of effectiveness. And we do that by recruiting career changers. We do that by helping teachers find placements that are a good fit. We do that in some states by helping teachers get certified through rigorous programs. But once they're in the classroom, and this is really what the Widget Effect Report is geared towards, we have to make sure that we know how effective they are in the classroom and that we're doing something to help them improve. And that's the area that we feel has probably been more are underexplored in many districts because the evaluation systems and the development systems have been so inadequate. We think that we'll focus increasingly in the coming years on trying to help districts address those issues because they're making more progress right now on pipeline issues than they are on effectiveness.
And do you do that through policy, through local conversations and coaching with superintendents? How does that really happen?
In the beginning, we focused mostly on providing technical assistance to districts where we actually ran programs for them. We would do recruitment and selection and training of teachers for them. And we still do that in a large number of districts. But as the years went on, we recognized that there were policy barriers that were getting in the way of excellent people becoming teachers and that we could not wait for someone else to solve those policy problems for our work to have its maximum impact. And so we set about trying to gather data to draw those problems into very sharp relief and then to use that data to make arguments for change. We've done that in a couple of different cases to try and highlight these issues which have been allowed to linger, we think, for far too long. A couple of examples of policies that get in the way of getting good people into the classroom would include really onerous certification processes. So people that already have a master's degree in their content area, say a master's degree in mathematics, they can't teach middle school math without going through a really extensive program of teacher education courses that oftentimes are not very rigorous but take a lot of time and cost a lot of money. And so many people opt not to get into the classroom because when you're a very in-demand professional, other firms are recruiting you to be part of their work, and there's no cost to get into that job. Whereas in teaching, we set up a lot of very high-cost barriers. And this one of the other barriers that often derails good people from becoming teachers is that they have so little say over where they teach. In many urban districts, 40 to 50% of teachers are assigned to a school without their say into a position, and they end up working in a work environment that's not a good fit for them, which is completely uncommon in other fields. Journalists don't have zero say over which newspaper they work for, and lawyers don't have zero say over which law firm. So in the modern workplace, there are some very unusual and archaic practices in education.
If you could wave a wand, make something happen in public education in America today, what would you do? What do you think would have the biggest leverage effect in moving student performance ahead?
I think the biggest thing that we should do is focus on only allowing teachers who prove their effectiveness to stay in the classroom. And you could say that they have to prove their effectiveness after 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. It could be whatever you choose it to be. But we have to have real systems that assess the effectiveness, are honest about the effectiveness, and we have to take action when we see ineffectiveness. Because the truth is that in far too many cases, a student who goes to an inner city school district is going to have access to a handful of great teachers over their K-12 experience. We need to change that so they have access to excellent teachers every year. And until we do that, we're going to continue to have a massive achievement gap. So I think the mechanism to do that is to say we're only going to allow teachers that demonstrate their effectiveness to continue working with our children.
Tim, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Timothy Daly is the president of the New Teacher Project. To read the report, The Widget Effect, or see more of the project's excellent work, head to our website, smartcityradio.com. And now, for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Renewable energy can do no wrong. It's on the lips of every politician and on the wish lists of people who a few years back couldn't even say photovoltaic. The benefits of renewable energy sources like wind and solar are undeniable. Cities get naturally created energy and a reduced carbon footprint, and everything is dandy. Well, everything within those cities, anyway. Out in rural places, the realities of renewable energy can be harsh and unavoidable. As a recent article from the rural news website The Daily Yonder reports, the transmission lines that would transport the energy from this new smart grid are causing political dust storms in rural areas across America. From Texas to California to New Mexico, rural residents are voicing opposition to projects that they say will devastate their local environments and local property values. It's estimated that more than 300,000 megawatts of renewable energy projects can't move forward because of lack of transmission capacity. It seems that turning America into a smart power country is going to require greater cooperation with the rural residents who absorb most of the downsides of renewable power and few of its benefits. Meanwhile, out in Colorado, two new laws are making it legal for residents to collect and reuse rainwater. A recent article from the New York Times looks at the new laws and why the state had previously prevented people from catching the water. Like some other states in the West, strict water ownership rights prevented collection of rainwater. But droughts and dwindling supplies are beginning to inspire changes. A 2007 study showed that 97% of rainwater falling directly on the ground in one Colorado county was absorbed by plants before it could reach any streams, leading lawmakers to decide that allowing residents to collect some of that water wouldn't contribute to further shortages. And finally, London is fuming over a surprise decision by Olympic organizers. Originally, the city's 2012 Olympic Stadium was planned to have 80,000 seats during the Games, but then be downsized to a more manageable 25,000 seats after the event. It was part of an effort to make sure the huge stadium would be able to remain relevant and useful after the Games. But now, according to an article from the Architects Journal, planners want to keep all 80,000 seats. They're hoping it will help England secure a bid for an upcoming Soccer World Cup. Critics say the change will likely result in greater debt for the country, and yet another hulking Olympic stadium going underused. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll hear about sustainability on a community scale from Joel Mills of the American Institute of Architects. And our producer, Scotty Iseri, will tell us about a travel website that steers you clear of the tourist traps and shows you cities as seen by the people who live in them. You're listening to Smart City. Another hello to our podcast listeners. You've probably heard us talk about our social networking site, MyCity. Well, we've added some new features to the site, including a widget for my Twitter stream and an embeddable Smart City audio player so you can add us to your blog or website. If you're not a member of Smart City, send an email to Scotty, the producer of Smart City, and he'll get you set up. The address is scotty@smartcityradio.com. I look forward to seeing you on the site, and now on with the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. When you travel to a city on vacation, you're bound to see some of the usual sights, the tourist traps, the monuments. But to get a real sense of the city, you need to go where the locals go. The website spottedbylocals.com can help. Our producer, Scotty Iseri, recently spoke with Bart Von Pohl, the co-owner of Spotted by Locals, about the site and found out why traditional guidebooks won't show you the real heart of a city.
Bart Von Pohl, thank you for joining us on Smart City.
Thank you for having us.
So what is Spotted by Locals?
Spotted by Locals is a series of 21 city blogs on 21 cities in Europe. Locals from these cities write about their favorite spots in the city they live in. I think what makes us different from regular guidebooks, our main competitors, is that our writers are real locals, whereas most travel guide writers are journalists, and journalists that don't really live in the city usually. And another big exception from guidebooks is that our tips are always up to date. Our locals regularly visit spots they write about. I think that's a big difference.
Who are these locals? What kind of background do they have? Where do you find them?
We find them in very different ways, and their backgrounds are very different. In age, for example, Jesper Jost from Ljubljana is 18, and one of our freshest spotters from our new city we're going to launch soon, Rotterdam, is Frederik, and he's 61. And some of our spotters are students. We also have a few CEOs of quite large companies. So they have a very different background, but they all love the city they live in. That's what they share, I think.
What do they get out of writing for the site?
They get a share of the income of their city blog. It's enough to buy a beer sometimes. So it's not really a motivation to do this for the money. And that's what we don't want that either, of course. We want people that really love their city. Yeah, we met all these locals ourselves in the cities they live in. to make sure that they are really motivated by sharing their passion for their city and not by money.
If I'm touring one of the cities and looking at your city blog, what do I get from a local instead of, say, a tour guide or from a tour book?
Yeah, what you get is real local tips. Our writers are locals, and if you buy a regular guidebook, like a Lonely Planet, for example, it's usually a journalist that writes to that's a writer, and it's usually a journalist that knows the city quite well. Some of them have even lived there, but most of them don't actually live there at the moment they're writing the guidebook. They are a little bit tourists themselves. And our locals really live in the city. They visit the places they write about. They write about everything they do in their city that's interesting for tourists. Potters actually write about everything they do themselves in their city. So, for example, like bars, restaurants, music, art and culture, but also things that you regularly won't find in the guidebook, for example, like places to relax, just a nice park to sit in or a nice square. Actually everything our locals do in their city.
You know, when people travel to a city, they often go places that they've heard of, the tourist traps, right? They'll go to the big monuments, the statues, the places that are on the postcards. But in their home city, they don't go to those places. But how would you think the local perspective could compete against these giant monuments, these places that are sort of built for tourists to go to?
It's a fascinating phenomenon. People seem to be attracted by the big monuments that have been there for hundreds of years that they see in their postcards and guidebooks. I'm always fascinated by tourists in Amsterdam, my city. I'd walk around the Leidseplein area. They seem to be hypnotized by the neon signs with the Hard Rock Cafe and coffee shop on them. To be honest, I don't really know why that is. And I must confess that I'm a bit like that myself when I visit a new city. And if I visit a new city, I want to see the highlights. But when I look back at an experience at a city I visited, I usually find the highlights the least interesting. It's usually like a nice encounter with a local, or drinking a local beer in a shabby bar or local club, for example. Those are the things that I talk about with when I go home again. So I'm slowly learning to skip more and more of the obvious highlights. It's not really easy, but I think it's much more rewarding to visit local spots. One that really comes to mind is a spot we visited in Ljubljana. It's the capital of Slovenia, and one of our spotters told us that there is one particular spot near the river where all the locals go to drink some wine. You buy a bottle of wine in the supermarket with two plastic glasses, and you just sit there. It was one of the most special things we've seen in Ljubljana. We talked to the locals there, and yeah, this is really not something you would find in a guidebook. And I think these are the kind of spots that our spotters write about.
There's a really great quote on your site that says, "A city's denizens experience their environment very differently." It says, "Their atlas is not the Lonely Planet. Theirs is an atlas of emotion." What is that atlas of emotion?
I wish I'd thought of that quote myself. Was an urbanist in Amsterdam who thought of that. The best way to explain it, I think, is to see the Eiffel Tower for the first time. It's all you can see. It absorbs all your senses. But if you live near the Eiffel Tower, one day it will start to be boring, I think. Other things are much more important for somebody who lives in the city. It's not the highlights, but it's the things that have to do with the work, friends, etc. If you live in a city, you're not really a voyeur, as they call it, but more like a voyageur, a French word for traveler, although you're at home. So it's a great theory.
Now, your background is not in urbanism or city planning, correct?
No, it's not at all. No, no, I'm an economist.
But I noticed you've got a section on the main Spotted by Locals blog that's dedicated to urbanism. What got you interested in it?
Well, we have two guest writers who really are urbanists, or one of them is like an official master in urbanism, and he writes about the real urbanism subjects, and I try to do it a little bit, but it's just from my amateur perspective. I just love cities. I've lived in Paris and Milan for a short while, in Seoul and South Korea for a year, and now I've been living in Amsterdam for 12 years. I really can't imagine living outside like a large city. I just love these. That's my. That's why I like reading about it and writing about it.
Bart Van Poel, thank you for joining us on Smart City. We look forward to checking out the information on Spotted by Locals.
Thank you, Scotty.
Bart Van Poel is the co-owner of the website Spotted by Locals. And finally this week, Joel Mills serves as the director of the American Institute of Architects Center for Communities by Design. The center is an excellent resource for architects and citizens who are looking to build healthy and sustainable buildings, but they're also taking their approach to whole communities with the Sustainable Design Assistance Team. The team works with communities to create recommendations for making one city cleaner and greener. I asked Joel what makes the design of a community sustainable.
Well, Carol, a lot of things go into sustainability when we're looking at the community scale. And I think the important thing that we try to bring to the process through a sustainable design assessment team is a holistic approach that is customized to a number of local issues that might be present, realizing that every single community has its own unique context. It has its own history and culture, and everybody's got their own unique take on local issues.
Well, what are the local issues that you assess? How do you assess sustainability in a community?
Sure. What we do is we operate on an annual schedule where communities apply to be a part of this program. We just kicked off the 2010 process, and communities can get information about that on our website. But what we do is we'll go into a community, we'll spend a day and a half with a team leader learning about their issues. They of course, outline some of those broadly in an application. And then based on our day and a half assessment, we will build a team of professionals that meet up and match those issues well. So in some cases, it may be economic development with a historic Main Street, connections to land transportation or land use issues in that community. It could be an update to a comprehensive plan. It really varies from community to community depending on what we're looking at, but the key is to assess the long-term sustainability, the ability of that community to meet their own needs and aspirations for generations forward. So it can range across a number of issues, but the key is to look at things as they relate to each other in a community and really bring a holistic approach so that you're not missing gaps between things, so you're making the appropriate connections between green building and updating ordinances and creating the right kinds of incentives to produce the outcomes that the community has expressed they'd like to see in the future.
Well, you're describing this in general terms, so it's hard to get a sense of what you're doing in a specific way. So give me an example of a city that you've worked with and how you've assessed sustainability and what recommendations you've given them for improving it.
I'll give you a couple of examples. We work in communities small and large. So I think the smallest community we've worked in was about 1,200 citizens, and the largest is either Detroit or Fort Worth, depending on current population figures. One of the most successful communities we've worked with is Dubuque, Iowa. We had a sustainable design assessment team out there a couple years ago, 2007, and they were looking at a number of key issues in that community related to managing growth, managing sprawl that was occurring in the community. They had some specific issues regarding bluff preservation and some of the development that was occurring, as well as stormwater management, runoff issues, and sustainable design and traditional development in their neighborhoods. All of this sort of in the context of revitalization. They have, in the 2 years since the project occurred, some of the things that were recommended were that they really formalize an initiative on sustainability in the community, which they did, but also to look at a unified code moving forward. They've put together some draft language on a unified code. They've been accepted as one of three communities in the country to the National Trust for Historic Preservation's new effort on Green Lab Cities, which is looking at cities that have exceptional capacity to address issues of sustainability. And so there's a lot of energy in Dubuque right now around some of the things that the team recommended. A little bit different take down in Texas. We worked with the city of Fort Worth, Texas, late last year. And one of the issues that they were facing is just the language and the discussion about sustainability. Folks in Fort Worth naturally hear a lot about Austin, Texas, as a leader in green building. There was a lot of discussion in that community about sustainability and whether they even wanted to be a sustainable community. And one of the things that the team pointed out was they're doing a lot of great things on sustainability already. Fort Worth, in fact, has one of the boldest planning initiatives in the country right now with their Trinity River Vision process, looking at reengineering some of the river and really creating quite a waterfront in that community. One of the things that we recommended that they do was create a formal office of sustainability to integrate some of the things that city agencies are working on in isolation currently. So bringing together a lot of some of the current efforts as well as suggesting some new things like civic indicators, working with the neighborhoods, building their capacity to address specific neighborhood planning initiatives. They do a lot of great things on that already. It's just about taking some of the energy that exists in the community and focusing that on some of the desired outcomes that they wanted to have.
So describe the work of a AIA Sustainable Design Assessment Team. Where do you get the members? How are they recruited? How do you find cities to work in? And then once you put the city and the team together, what happens?
Sure. We have an annual application process. Communities apply every year for a Sustainable Design Assessment Team. And the process just kicked off this week. Our deadline is November 13th of this year. We'll be forming a review committee to look at community applications and assess them. And then we typically award between 8 and 10 communities for a year. Once we've done that, we schedule an initial assessment with a team leader who's an architect or planner, as well as a staff member, and they'll come out to a community, meet with key stakeholders, meet with city staff and public officials, get a deeper sense of some of the issues that they think are important issues to address through this SHRET process. And then we'll go back and we'll recruit a multidisciplinary team that comes back to the community for a 3-day, very intensive grassroots-style community process where we'll look deeply at some of the issues that they're facing, come up with some design suggestions in some cases, some policy suggestions in some cases, and provide a public presentation back to that community the evening of the third day with our observations and recommendations moving forward. And then typically within a year to 2 year period, we'll schedule a follow-up visit to see how things are going with implementation. Obviously, we'll have conference calls and conversations that continue after the team's visit, but we'll have a formal sort of follow-up visit, typically within a 2-year time frame, just to see how things are going, what's changed, you know, what's worked really well, that kind of thing. But the unique thing about this program is that it's combining sort of three principles for us, one of which is bringing multidisciplinary expertise to play. The teams are typically led by an architect, but involve, you know, 6 to 8 professionals that have a range of backgrounds that meet the existing issues in a community. None of those professionals will come from that community or that state. They'll come from elsewhere. They're not being paid. They're not developing business. And so they're able to provide a relative objectivity and a lot of credibility in the recommendations that they come up with. And that gives us a lot of energy from the public. People get really excited about the opportunity to have some outside eyes look at things they may have looked at in their community for decades. The third sort of important piece for us is the public participation piece. We talk about this national team of experts coming to town, but we also acknowledge that there's a group of local experts that are really important to the process, that folks that have lived in a community for generations obviously have a great insight on some of the things that they face in the past and some of the ideas they have about the future. And we try to bring those elements together in a process that can come up with sometimes very unique suggestions for a community, and sometimes reinforcing existing ideas that may be present, and really providing a catalyst in terms of an outside set of eyes to help a community move forward with implementation on some of these things.
How many cities have you done this work in?
We've worked in just over 40 communities by the end of this year through this program. It began in 2005. It's based on a longer program of the AIA's called the Regional Urban Design Assistance Team, which dates back to 1967. And we still have that program. We work in about two communities a year through that process. It's sort of the same approach to programmatically to the process, but it's focused a little bit more on urban design issues.
Where do you get the most leverage in moving towards sustainable design? Where's the biggest payoff?
I think that the key thing when we look at sustainability, I think it's really coming of age now when you look at this, and I think the timing is right for a significant initiative that can really have impact at a broader scale. I mean, you look at a lot of the dialogue internationally now about climate change and the renewed interest in international collaboration around that issue and related issues. We look at the national discussion about the stimulus package, about green jobs. The EPA has recently declared climate change an issue of significance for that agency. And we look at the regional scale in terms of watersheds, transportation infrastructure. There's a lot of interest that's tying into looking at things from a sustainable viewpoint. But we believe where it really matters, where we get down to the bread and butter, is at the local level. That's where change is really going to happen. That's where innovation has always taken place. The bottom line is that every community has its own unique context. We can definitely facilitate change at other levels. We can facilitate new collaboration, but where things are really going to change is at the local level with addressing things in their unique context.
And what are the biggest barriers to change at a local level?
Oh, I think it's a variety of things at the local level. In some places, it's a simple capacity issue where you have a small community. They may not even have a planning department, let's say, and it's a matter of identifying the proper partnerships both within and outside of government to create enough capacity to really take on some of the key challenges and implement effectively. In other areas, it's an issue of culture. Obviously, sustainability is a new idea in some communities, and there's a need to educate folks about a lot of the current thought and planning and what works and, what the experience has been. And that conversation takes time, and it's an intensive conversation to have. But getting public support for any major planning initiatives, whether that's infrastructure or transportation plans, or whether that's neighborhood development, is obviously a key thing. And I think that we're seeing a lot more interest at the local level around sustainable ideas. There was a recent survey, I think in the last week, of just large cities that Living Cities did, and 80% of those cities rank sustainability as a top five issue. On the state level, we've seen recently in New Jersey a new initiative called Sustainable New Jersey that in the first 3 months, this is a voluntary initiative to certify local governments. In the first 3 months, 187 municipalities signed up. So there's definitely a lot of interest in pursuing new programs, new initiatives around sustainability and thinking this way long-term as other things like the stimulus package and infrastructure development are taking place.
Joel, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol. I really appreciate it.
Joel Mills directs the Center for Communities by Design at the American Institute of Architects. His interview was engineered by Monitor Studios. That's it for this week's show, but there's more Smart City if you come to our website, smartcityradio.com. You can listen to archive shows, subscribe to our podcast, or sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also send us questions, comments, kudos, or critiques by clicking on the contact button or sending an email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He's listening to Alice Cooper, and I can't get Michael Jackson out of my mind. I'm Carol Coletta.